now back to Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise.
Thank you all for staying tuned to the second hour of the show. I'm Dr. Rita Louise. Remember, Just Energy Radio is brought to you by SoulHealer.com, the Institute of Applied Energetics. That's AppliedEnergeticsInstitute.com. And you can always sign up for our Soul Healer at www.JustEnergyRadio.com or get access to our over 4 years, going on 5 years, worth of archives. So in this hour, we're going to be speaking with Brian Forrester about the megalithic buildings of the Inca. And here's a little bit about Brian, and we will get him on. The study of the Inca culture led Brian to writing a book, A Brief History of the Incas, and is also actively engaged with Native Shipibo people of Central, from the Central Amazon of Peru, promoting the sale of their traditional arts and crafts. In addition to his now 4 books, he writes articles for Graham Hancock. He is also associated with Loy Pai of the Star Child Project, who is analyzing the DNA of elongated human skulls of the Peruvian Paracas culture on his behalf. Brian will be joining David Hatcher Childress and Hugh Newman of Megalithomania on a tour of Peru and Bolivia November 10th through 20th. We're going to have to definitely ask him about that. So please welcome to Just Energy Radio, Brian Forrester. Hey, Brian, how are you?
I'm very well. How about you?
I am wonderful. I gathered you are actually in Peru talking to us today.
I am in Lima, as a matter of fact.
Do you spend a lot of time in Peru?
I live in Peru.
You live in Peru? How cool.
Yeah.
Is it a cool place to live?
It's great because it's completely different from Canada and the U.S., you know, where I've lived most of my life. So I have to get used to speaking another language and be one of the only blonde-haired, blue-eyed people around who's tall. And, you know, it's just thousands upon thousands of years of native culture here. So it's a never-ending learning curve.
Well, I guess you're very handy for taking things off the top shelf for people.
Well, that's true.
How did you get into this whole study in the first place of the Inca and become involved with the native people in the Amazon?
Well, it basically started from childhood. I grew up on the west coast of Canada, and when I was about 8 or 9, I started having the basic questions about, the nature of reality. And I thought, well, in this environment, who would I ask questions about history and culture and, the natural world? And I thought white people or Europeans who predominantly live in the area have only been there 100 years, whereas the native people have been there for at least 10,000. So I just naturally started to get involved in the oral traditions, became actually professional totem pole carver, which I did for a number of years. Then I moved to Hawaii and got involved with the Hawaiian culture, building a 62-foot double-hull sailing canoe destined for Tahiti. And after that, about 5 years ago, one morning I woke up and a little voice kept saying in my ear, Peru, Peru, Peru. So I arrived in Peru and the doors just started opening for me.
Wow, that sounds really cool. Yeah, I used to live in the Seattle area and there really is a strong native culture there. I mean, you don't see it in a lot of other places in the country, but there, you know, it's out there, it's available, you can interact with it, which I think is really wonderful.
Yeah, especially on the west coast of Canada, because the Haida people who live on the Queen Charlotte Islands about halfway up the coast are the most famous in the world as totem pole carvers. So it's from them and the Kwagyul people that I started to learn when I was a teenager. And they found it odd because, you know, they kept kind of questioning, why does a white person want to know this? But, now native studies is, it's kind of common amongst people. But when I was a kid, it was, you know, thought to be kind of strange. But that's part of being a trend seeker, I guess, or a trendsetter.
Yeah, that's it. On your website, hiddeninkatours.com, there's a picture of you standing in front of a cornerstone at, and I'm hoping I'm going to say this right because it has a lot of letters, Sacsayhuaman.
Oh, Sacsayhuaman.
Sacsayhuaman. there. sorry, no phonics skills. My listeners are used to me this way. If you compare, I mean, for the listeners, and I wish I had a picture on the website. I mean, the stone is huge, huge. If you compare the size of this stonework at this site to like a block in the pyramids, you know, because I think people can recognize how big the blocks in the pyramids are, you know, and they're big. But if you compared one of those blocks to some, you know, that stone or some of the other stones that are in that wall, do they relate? I mean, are we talking bigger, smaller, kind of parallel in nature?
Well, the ones at Sacsayhuaman are amongst the largest in the world. The only other place could possibly be Karnak in Lebanon, and also in certain places in Egypt, like the Osirian, I believe, and where they're that kind of massive, and at Tiwanaku in Bolivia. But the stone in question that I'm standing in front of is about 100, you know, a lot of people who've been there like to boast and say it's, you know, 1,000 tons, but realistically it's 120 tons. It's 18 feet tall, 8 feet wide, and 6 feet thick. But it's the, that's the in terms of megalithic building, that is the ultimate example in Peru of huge stones being perfectly positioned in place, three-dimensionally interconnecting with other ones of, you know, similar kind of size.
That was an interesting statement, three-dimensionally, when you look at the pictures of, the, of those stones, because they're fitted together like a puzzle, and you just think of the two-dimensionality. When you look, you know, behind the front plate, is there actually a third dimension? Do they angle down or angle up or to the side?
Well, the thing is, each one is of a different size and shape, but each and every one interlocks with the ones above, to the left, to the right, and below, with almost perfect precision. The, you know, the sort of basic statement is said that you can't fit a piece of paper in between, and in general, that's true. And the that's where so-called alternative researchers, researchers like myself and Graham Hancock and David Childress, differ with the basic story of conventional archaeology, because their explanation is that it took a process of trying to fit the stone into place, pulling it back out, shaping it, and continually doing this, you know, using this technique to make them all fit, not taking into account the fact that these weigh 100 tons.
Good point. What are the stones made of? Are they a hard stone and difficult to carve, or are they a fairly easy stone to work?
Well, that's, again, another you know, really good question, because the conventional story says that they're sandstone or limestone. Limestone is really quite soft in general, and you can shape it. Sandstone's a little harder. And it's the thing where, you know, if you read the conventional accounts and you think that, you know, that what they're saying is exactly the truth, you're kind of getting brainwashed. And the last time I went, I finally went right up to it, you know, to some of these stones, you know, having spent 5 years studying the entire area around Cusco. And I looked and I thought, oh, my God, this stone is andesite. And andesite is as hard or harder than granite. So, you know, a lot of the conventional archaeologists will say, well, it wouldn't be that difficult because it's made out of limestone, but it's not. It's much, much harder than that. So that makes the whole feat, you know, many times more difficult than I originally thought.
In South America, you know, and I hate just keep comparing it to Egypt, but I think people, you know, have seen enough shows and have, you know, gotten the brainwashing enough to make the comparison. You know, but they talk about they use copper tools and stones and to make the pyramids. In South America, what kind of tools did they have to use to even carve these stones up or form them?
Well, that's exactly the point. The only tools that have been found that the Inca had were bronze chisels and stone hammers. And it's exactly the same thing that they say about Egypt. The problem is that no one can actually show an example of how this is done. I'm a sculptor, and I've worked in stone, so I have an idea of how difficult it is to work in stone. Limestone, like I said, is quite simple, but granite's incredibly difficult. A bronze chisel would take two strikes on that stone, and it would be dull. So what that tells us is the Inca were not responsible. It was an older culture that had a higher form of technology than what the Inca had, and that is exactly the same story in Egypt. Thanks to my relationship with people like David Childress and also Christopher Dunn, who wrote the book The Giza Power Plant.
We've had him on.
Oh, good.
Fascinating.
The one thing I, especially love about Chris is the fact that he's very, he's an engineer and he's very pragmatic. And he's, if he says this was, that a certain thing was done with power tools or some kind of power tool, he's speaking as an engineer. He's not being hypothetical. He's saying, we can see the cuts in the stone. The only way that could be done is with, a diamond powered tip saw. As compared to, other authors who will say, well, the aliens came with unknown technology, which is possible. But at least, thankfully, Chris is completely pragmatic. And he says, I can see evidence of, core drilling here, and I can see evidence of this there. And that, again, is something that we're seeing in Peru and Egypt. The two of them seem to have had the same kind, not necessarily the same ancient culture, but the same technologies seem to have been used.
What I find interesting, you have a site like the one we've just been talking about, but then you have a site like Puma Punku, that it's very geometric and it's very carved. Is there any thought as to, is one earlier than the other, later than the other?
Well, what seems to be really clear now is that Puma Punku is probably the oldest site in South America. And the funny thing is that it shows the highest forms of technology being used as well. So that's, of course, completely opposite to what we're taught in school. We're taught that civilizations start, from cave people and go up to people being able to fly in airplanes. But, the people who, so-called alternative researchers or spiritual people who you speak with, they always talk about human history in terms of cycles of time, and they often speak as well about that, technology and civilizations rose and fell. Atlantis, of course, being the classic example of that.
And let's stay with the site that we started with. Are there any myths or legends that are associated with the construction of the site there?
Well, basically with Sacsayhuaman, what happened was that when the first Spanish arrived in Cusco about 1533, they asked the Inca or those Inca that were left alive, they said, did you build this? And the Inca said, no, this was here when we got here. And that's reminiscent also of, for example, Tiwanaku is the same, because Garcia Lasso de la Vega is the most famous chronicler. He was half Inca. I just actually have finished a book about him this morning, writing it this morning. But it's the same story. When the Incas first went to Tiwanaku in order to expand their civilization, they looked and they said, they asked the local people, who built this? You? And they said, no, it wasn't us. And the Spanish as well, when the Spanish arrived, they asked the Inca about Tiwanaku and said, did you build this? And they went, no, this was here.
I love reading some of those old chronicles where they ask them questions, and it's like, oh, well, they couldn't possibly know any of this stuff, and everything they say is absurd. And it's just, I can just envision the Spaniards, doing that. Anyway.
It's simple racism. I think what the Spanish were, basically blown away by is the fact that, coming from Europe and having cathedrals and that sort of thing, there was nothing in Europe, commonly known of that could compete in terms of engineering with what they found in South America. So it's like, how could these people do it when we can't?
Mm-hmm. Also at Sacsayhuaman, there are I mean, it's just this whole city. I mean, it's not just this one structure. And, you know, looking at the pictures, you know, there are the stone terraces and multiple structures at that location. And one of the things I was curious, and I'm kind of curious as we talk about some of these other sites as well, is how many people do they think live there? Or, and I'm putting this in quotations, was it a ritual site? You know, they're all ritual sites, but any ideas about how many people live there?
Well, in the city of Cusco, you know, Sacsayhuaman is just above Cusco. You can actually see Sacsayhuaman from the central square, the Plaza de Armas in Cusco. It's up on the hill directly north, basically. And at the time that the Spanish arrived, again in 1533 in Cusco, the population of that city was at least 250,000. Presently, it's about 450,000, but it was the center of the Inca culture. And the more that I research it, especially looking at the megaliths, it's becoming more and more obvious that the Inca, when they arrived in Cusco in the 1200s, some of the buildings were already there, including Sacsayhuaman, and they simply, like anybody would go, wow, these buildings are great. They're cool. Let's make use of them. But that's the waters become muddied, thanks, quote unquote, to archaeologists and anthropologists who insist that everything in Cusco and everything around Cusco was built by the Inca. But the more you do the research, the more that statement is completely, you know, basically corny. It's just not true.
I don't know. One of the things that I always find fascinating about the Inca Empire in particular is the terraces that they built and some of the walkways that they built, to get from one city to another. And
yeah,
it just amazes me. You look at some of the images and there's a rock terrace kind of going off a giant cliff. Why? Any thought as to why they would build that way or build in those locations?
Well, again, the more that I do the research, the more it is that what the Inca are said to have done becomes more clear, and more of the sites that I'm looking at are, you know, showing themselves to not be Inca, including the highway system or the roads. There were two major roads, one along the ocean and one in the highlands, just below the Andes. And both of those now are the actual highways that cars drive on. The builders were so smart at engineering and figuring out where to put the roads that the Pan American Highway, for example, that goes down the coast of Peru is the Inca Road. And the whole system at the peak of the Inca civilization was 25,000 to 30,000 kilometers in size. And also, the more that I look at it and the more that I read the old chronicles, especially the ones written by the Inca descendants, they speak of the fact that a lot of those roads were already there before they arrived. What they did is they improved on them.
And let me ask a question, just because I don't really know. Is that area that mountainous, and are you really required to navigate roads like that to get from one end of the country to another?
Well, the whole road system is very intelligent because if anyone does travel along the Pan American Highway down the coast of Peru, it's not right on the coast. It's built right on the edges of the cliffs, far enough inland that they were able to create quite, you know, major straight lines, so without having too much zigzagging. And the same thing was the case up in the highlands areas of the Andes, is that they tried whenever possible to make the road as straight as possible. So that's why the inland road is below the peaks of the Andes themselves, because, you know, if they went too high up, then everything would be a hairpin turn and a zigzag. So very intelligent engineers planned and, you know, built what is still used today.
Based on your study, you know, and I don't know if you've ever looked at this, at other cultures around the world, have there been other ones that have created a road system in that way? I mean, not necessarily on the mountains, but with that kind of intelligent design?
Not as far as I can tell, or at least there are no signs that I know of that we can see as major as that system was. And that was part of the reason why the Inca civilization was so successful, was because they had this major interconnecting system of roads. So, you know, the military could move very easily. The transport of products could be done very efficiently. They also had what were called tambos, which were like little hotel-like buildings every 5 to 10 miles. So any traveler on the road at nightfall would find a place to stay that was full of food. Strategically, that was supposedly done for the military, but any traveler on the highway could use it. You know, so very efficient for, at minimum, 500 years ago.
That's pretty cool. Let's turn to the rock terraces, because they always fascinate me. And actually, I was kind of blown away when I found out that there were rock terraces very similar to the ones in Peru in South America, which I thought was interesting in general. Do they still use those?
Yeah, they do, which is great. I would say about 10 to 20% are still in use. And in the Sacred Valley, which is just outside of Cusco, that's where you find the most beautiful and still used examples. And these terraces they go from the valley floor to the very tops of mountains. So we're talking several thousand feet vertically going up. And each, as the higher up you go in altitude, you go through different microclimate changes. And so the Inca and probably people before that were so intelligent at being able to crossbreed their different plants that the higher up you went, they would plant different subspecies or species of their food products in order to optimize the environment. And that's why, for example, there are 2,000 different kinds of potatoes, each one specifically bred to fit a very particular environment.
I just can't even imagine walking up that hill to go get the tomatoes at the top or whatever.
Well, I've done some climbing up there. They're very efficiently built, but it's still yikes. You know, it's a tough go.
Well, but they just look, you know, like an e-ticket ride, you know, just the incline. I mean, one of the things that I find interesting is, you know, the Egyptian pyramid. I mean, they have kind of a normal angle, you know, kind of more of a 45-degree angle. But when you look at the South American pyramids, I mean, I've been to Chichen Itza, and I've kind of explored that whole Mayan area. But when you climb up the stairs up those pyramids, I mean, they're like at a 60-degree angle, and they had a big old chain that you could hang on to get up. And then, I don't know about you, but I came down feet first and kind of sat my way down the stairs because it was it took your breath away. In South America, it seems like those terraces, you find the same thing. Like, I don't know that I'd want to walk down those giant hills, but the people back then did.
Well, that's an interesting point, because the steps actually are quite wide. And what my wife is Peruvian, and what she pointed out the first time that we went to Cusco is she's about 5'3" or 5'4", which is standard for a Peruvian woman. And she was having difficulty climbing, and she said, you know, the Inca must have been tall people. And, you know, I'm six feet, and I thought, well, this is kind of comfortable for me. And at first I thought, oh, I don't think so. You know, everyone in South America is pretty short. But the more you read, the chronicles and older stories, the Inca themselves were a family of people. The Inca does not refer to the entire population. It was solely the ruling class. And the chronicles and other stories say that the Inca were tall people. They were very light skin. Some of them had red hair or even reddish blonde hair. And they only bred within the family. So that's another major factor. It's like, you know, the royal bloodline thing was very important to the Inca people. But they, you know, they must have been tall, because the staircases, at least in the palace areas, are very, you know, like what we would call normal size today.
That's really interesting. I lost my thought. All right, let me see. Let me look at the time here real quick. There it is. Actually, you know what? We need to go to a break. I guess it's good that I looked at the clock because we really do need to go to a break. So after we come back, maybe we can turn our attention to Machu Picchu, which is always exciting to talk about. Okay?
Sure.
All right. If the music comes up. There it is. All right. I'm Dr. Rita Louise. We're talking to Brian Forrester. His webpage is hiddenincatours.com, and we'll be back with Brian after these words from our sponsors.
Dr. Rita Louise will return right after these messages.
Is your body performing at its peak level? Are you experiencing physical pain or having trouble sleeping? Ciara holographic chips can help you to restore balance to your body and provide you with the relief you've been looking for. The Ciara chip works similar to an acupuncture treatment. It communicates directly with the body through our human electromagnetic field. These transparent chips are non-transdermal and contain no drugs or other harmful substances. Our chips can be used to support pain relief, sleep enhancement, and increased energy. Ciara chips are also available to help you deal with sinus allergies as well as the harmful effects of EMF radiation. For more information about this remarkable new scientific breakthrough in health technology, visit productsforthesoul.com. Journey to the dark side of the spirit world and meet the bad kids on the block in Dark Angels, an insider's guide to ghosts, spirits, and attached entities. Who are these bad kids? As a child, you might have met one at night, under your bed, in your closet, or down a dark hallway. Dark Angels is an adult dissertation about ghosts. It's filled with revealing information about how these dark forces can influence our lives. Order your copy of Dark Angels today. Visit www.darkangelsbook.com for more information.
And now back to Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise.
Hello and welcome back to Just Energy Radio. I'm Dr. Rita Louise and we're here talking to Brian Forrester. His book, or the one that we're kind of talking about, I don't know what your other two books are, so you'll have to mention those. A Brief History of the Incas, his website, hiddenincatours.com. Brian, before the break, I suggested we talk a little bit about Machu Picchu. Just my commentary, and I'd like to hear what you have to say. When you look at images of it, it seems like there was a certain amount of building that happened at one point in time because the rocks seem big, and then there's another course of stonework above that where they're smaller, although the finish on them, the fitting is really tight. And in your observations, is it multiple levels of building on that site?
Yeah, it's basically three different civilizations were there. The last one was the Inca, and they were responsible for about 85 to 90% of it. But it's the most intriguing structures and buildings, which are the remnants of previous cultures. The most famous thing that everybody wants to see is the hitching post of the sun, which is at Machu Picchu, and that is evidence of possibly a civilization that was there about 20,000 years ago. And the most intriguing thing about the hitching post is the fact that it's, you know, it's not that it's simply that it's an engineering and sculptural marvel, but the fact that it is not simply one piece of stone, it's the top of the mountain itself. So whoever the builders were, it was important energetically that the hitching post be the top of the mountain. And then there are two other areas. One's called the Temple of the Sun, and the other is the Temple of the Condor. And they show obvious signs that someone was there before. The majority of Machu Picchu is like reasonably well built in terms of masonry, but the earlier cultures were the ones that were far superior.
You said that everybody wants to see the hitching post of the sun. To be honest, kind of not that impressed.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know that it was the top of the mountain. I didn't know that. So that's a new fact. But I mean, I'm like, I don't know. So what's the big thing about it? Because maybe I missed something.
Well, the conventional story about the hitching post is that it was a solar calendar. But that's, you know, the amount of effort that went into making it suggests that it had a far more profound purpose, which I'm learning it did. For example, each of the four corners points specifically to a mountain in the distance. And what people have found out when they've been in helicopters is that they've followed those lines, each one of those four lines, and on top of each one of those mountains is another one of these hitching posts. So that would be a really difficult effort for, you know, anybody to do, the Inca or anyone. And what they what the real symbolism and function is, no one can, you know, I haven't been able to find out exactly, but I do know that there's a little angle that's on the top of the north face or the north corner that points exactly to magnetic north. So it's not just true north. There's also a magnetic north component to it. But again, no one really knows, because no one knows the identity of the original builders.
Okay, so that's pretty impressive. When I first saw it, actually in college in a class on Incan art, I thought, ooh, ritual sacrifice. And then actually this past year they were doing a show, and I think it was on Tiwanaku, Tecnotitlan in Mexico, and they were showing some site that I'd never seen before, which is always cool to see a new, you know, structure and stuff. And they had this thing on a pyramid, and they said, well, this is, you know, where they did the ritual sacrifice. And I said, it looks just like the hitching post of the sun.
Yeah, well, the Inca did do sacrifice or human sacrifice in a very, very limited way. But the church, for example, ever since the 16th century, in order to make the descendants of the Inca feel feel badly about their ancestors, and that's a great way to convert people. They made up a lot of stories, you know, stating that the Inca were, you know, into blood sacrifice and pulling people's hearts out. It's simply not true. And when I was up, I think on my fourth trip to Machu Picchu, there was a Peruvian tour guide who was saying, you know, exactly that to tourists, you know, said, well, this, you know, this giant slab of stone, which, you know, isn't Inca, it's much older, you know, was used for ritual sacrifice of people. And I honestly chewed her out, and I said, how could you possibly say that about the ancestors of, you know, people of your own country? Where are you getting your information from? And she said, I don't know. So, you know, I just,
History
I don't,
channel.
Probably. It's just, it offends me when, you know, when ancient people who are not here to speak for themselves are misrepresented. So that's why I've been, you know, delving deeper and deeper into Inca history to get as clear a story as I can as to who they were and what they did.
And I think this is true, that the Mayan were pretty big on sacrifice. And so is it a misconception that the Inca were also involved in that culture?
No, I think the whole thing about the Maya as well, I think a lot of that is a fabrication as well. The Aztecs supposedly were. The Aztecs actually showed up in the Valley of Mexico in the 1400s, you know, and so Teotihuacan, you know, which is the great series of temples outside Mexico City, that wasn't built by the Aztecs. That was built by the Toltecs. And with the Maya, what it really seems is that the majority of sacrifices happened probably close to or at the time of contact with Europeans, because the societies themselves were starting to collapse, and so they prayed to what was left of their thoughts of their, you know, of their supreme being, and saying, you know, why have you forsaken us in this way? And the same is true of Easter Island, which is, you know, my next major area that I'm starting to explore.
I just learned that there were megalithic structures there, not just the sculptures, but that there's actually stonework that looks like the stonework that's in Peru, which kind of blew me away.
Well, exactly, and that shows more and more, as I and others do the research, that whoever the earlier builders were, as in pre-Inca, possibly 10,000 years ago even, that the builders at places like Tiwanaku and Cusco and the area around Cusco were probably the same people as the builders at Easter Island, because the stonework is exactly the same, and they were probably a major seafaring culture that knew the Pacific Ocean very well. So they would have used a place like Easter Island almost like a stopping off place to get fresh water and food as they traveled beyond. So it's almost like, you know, going from one airport to another, except it's ocean going.
Going back to Machu Picchu, I meant to ask you this. How old do you think it is? You know, when you look at the earliest structures, any ideas about dates or anything like that?
Well, actually, Graham Hancock has a good discussion in his book, Fingerprints of the Gods. It's only about three paragraphs about it. But what he said is that three researchers in the 1950s, I believe, used archaeoastronomy, and they calculated that at least the road system in the city, or the, you know, the street system in the city, was planned at least 3,000 years ago. But the older and more even most profound structures there, like the, you know, the hitching post and a few others, they hint at pre-flood time, so before the end of the Ice Age. So that's, you know, 12,000 years plus.
Why would anybody stay there? It just seems really off the beaten path for anyone. From what I understand, there's not even water up there.
Oh, actually, no. There's an amazing irrigation system that they built. Just phenomenal. The water comes down from the high mountains and is channeled directly to Machu Picchu. And at least 40% of the entire structure is still underground, and it's a system of moving water around underneath the city itself. You know, there are a lot of different stories about who built it, why was it built, and the predominant, or I think most logical theory, is that it was built the equivalent of Camp David is in the U.S., and that's that it was a place where the Inca and the high officials went to get away from, you know, society in order to discuss the affairs of state. So it would have been heavily guarded at the two entrances so that these people could be in peace and discuss, you know, what needed to be done in terms of government and belief systems and the military. Again, almost exactly the function of Camp David.
One of the things that I'm curious about, and maybe you've heard a legend or not, are there any legends of gods living there at one point in time, like gods, quote unquote, living there? And the reason I'm asking that, when you look at cultures around the world, the gods lived on the top of the mountain. And when I look at Machu Picchu, I think, well, that's living on the top of the mountain.
Well, actually, that is the best possible question anybody on planet Earth could ask, and thank you, because it is, well, the place, it's not called Machu Picchu. That's not its traditional name. It's just Hiram Bingham in 1911, the great American explorer, when he, when he found it, or, you know, more correctly stumbled across it because a little native boy showed him where it was. He was told there are structures you are looking for on Machu Picchu. So Machu Picchu is the name of the mountain itself, but he labeled it Machu Picchu, and that's been the name ever since. The real name I found out from Jesus Gamara, who is an expert living in Cusco, and is not known outside of the city of Cusco, but he said the name of that place is Iyampu. And Iyampu means where the gods dwell, or the resting place of the gods.
I knew it.
You did know it.
And,
well done.
And no legends that have come down that kind of follow that line, or has it just been forgotten over time?
Well, the thing is, Machu Picchu during the, or, you know, Iyampu, during the time of its functioning, which was the basically the 15th century, you know, the century before the Spanish arrived, the majority was built by this one Inca called Pachacutec. And it was kept, as a secret place, because that's where the officials wanted to go and not have the population bug them. It's always been kept in secrecy. It's early history no one really knows about, but it's so difficult today it's simple, but in the past it would have been so difficult to even find where it was. It would have been simple for it to have disappeared from history the way it did. For example, when you take the train from this place called Ollantaytambo, which takes you to the little town near there called Aguas Calientes, a lot of people, I'm sure, when they're on the train think, well, you know, we'll get off the train and then we'll see Machu Picchu. But you have no idea where it is until you take the bus and you do the zigzag tour up, you know, up the mountainside, and all of a sudden it appears. It's completely, you know, cut off from the rest of the world. And it was meant, you know, for that reason. And it's quite probable that the first builders wanted it to be that way as well. They probably wanted it as a sanctuary and access to be completely restricted.
I like that. I'm just looking at the clock. So one of the other things, and we're going to kind of move on here. One of the other sites that I wanted to talk to you about was Amaru Muru? Blah, the Gateway of the Serpent. How's that? I can speak the English one.
Okay. Amaru Muru.
That one.
Yeah. Amaru Quechua is the Inca language. It's also called Runa Simi, but Quechua is the most common term used. And the Quechua word for snake is Amaru, and Muru is portal, or can be gate as well, I believe. But it's it's an amazing place on the southwest side of Lake Titicaca.
I find it interesting because we have the Gateway of the Sun, you know, and then there's this Gateway of the Serpent. And when you look at them culturally, they have the sun god, they have the serpent god. Is there a connection between that whole thing, between the sun god and the Gateway of the Sun and the Gateway of the Serpent with the serpent god?
Well, it depends on who you have as a, you know, as a consultant or as a guide for Amaru Muru. For myself, I think if anyone wants to look at it, you can Google it or use something like Bing Images. And Amaru Muru is AmaruMuru. And I think, you know, it's this big red sandstone wall, and then carved into the wall is this, doorway where I can basically fit. I'm 6 feet tall, so I can basically fit myself in there. The most interesting story is that it's a remnant from the lost continent of Mu, which supposedly was in the Pacific Ocean, and the high priest from there was called Aramu Muru, and he supposedly brought the teachings as the continent was disappearing or sinking or whatever. He brought the teachings to South America. And Amaru Muru was used as this, you know, one of the safe havens or places to store the knowledge. Other than that, even the local people have no idea who made it or when it was made. The more common name for it is the Devil's Door, but that, of course, is, you know, Catholic influenced.
I mean, it just seems kind of mysterious because there's the doorway, but it doesn't go anywhere. I mean, it does, but it doesn't.
Yeah, well, people, you know, some people think it's a stargate, or it's a place where you can project your, you know, your essence or your mind through it by focusing, you know, by putting your third eye on the stone, and you can focus your energy and move from that portal to, there are other ones that look almost exactly like it, at least the doorway itself around Cusco. They're all very ancient, but it's almost thought by some people that it's almost like the equivalent of a telephone booth, where you you know, you can focus your mind, focus your spirit or your mental energy can go in, and then it comes out at one of these other places. Some people have said you can physically move in, but I think that's kind of silly.
Yeah, but what if they had transporters back then?
Well, that is possible. You know, the thing is, when we talk about ancient technology, we have no idea what these past civilizations could have had, because we automatically think, well, must be lasers, you know, because we're always thinking in the context of what we know. But according to someone like Christopher Dunn and other, you know, experts in the area, as well as Stephen Mailer, who you may have interviewed, they talk more about that in Egypt and Peru, they had some kind of ultrasonic tools, as in high-speed sound tools, that they were able to use to carve stone. And, you know, who knows what else they had?
I don't know. Has anybody ever done any, like, digging behind that rock or any seismic ground-penetrating radar around that structure to see if there was actually something behind that gateway?
Well, that's another really intelligent question. You know, you're obviously a very intuitive person, because, we had a local guide from the village, and he said, you know, after we saw the door, et cetera, we went around behind it, and there's an opening, and he said that is a tunnel, and the tunnel goes from there to Cusco, which is about, you know, it's more than 100 miles. And so I, of course, crawled in, and I was, unfortunately, there was a fall of stone blocking. I could go in about 20 feet, but then I couldn't go farther. But that's the reoccurring theme about there and at Tiwanaku and at other places. There tend to be these openings which have been blocked off, but entrances to tunnels, and every one of those tunnels goes back to Cusco. So to me, that tells me that Cusco is much older than the Inca, and that all of these, you know, possibly pre-diluvian or, you know, pre-flood sites were interconnected by this ancient civilization whose name and other information about is going to, you know, take me the rest of my life. But, hey, got to do something.
How big are these caves? And I have a kind of a follow-up question, but, I mean, could you walk in it? Did you have to kind of crawl through it?
Yeah, I had to go on hands and knees, but the guide told me that the farther you go in, then you can stand up. Unfortunately, like I said, there was a rock fall inside of it. And there's one actually at Sacsayhuaman that goes all the way, well, it's 2 miles supposedly, that goes underground to the center of Cusco. But the Peruvian government has, you know, blocks these places off because they don't want, you know, people to get lost or people to, you know, sue them. So I'm still looking, you know, I'm still looking for the one that's open, and I'm very tempted to go, you know, camera in hand and a ropes to make sure I can get my way back out again.
Very much so. I just find it interesting when you start investigating these ancient sites and ancient structures that they all have tunnels or caverns beneath them, and then there's a lot of them that they're just these, you know, they're not very tall, so you're crawling around through these things. It's like, well, why build them if they're dinky?
Well, I think, you know, one possibility is the fact that they wanted the entry points to be really small so that they wouldn't be obvious to the general public, because even in ancient times, they may have had, you know, a very high spiritual use, which would have been restricted to the selected priesthood. You know, so I think that kind of makes sense. You want to make the openings not very visible, because you don't want anybody who isn't, you know, supposed to be there entering into them. But, you know, the most fascinating one, which I don't know if I'll ever find out, is there supposedly is one that goes from Tiwanaku all the way to the northwest coast of Peru following a straight line. And almost all of the most famous sacred sites fit exactly along this straight line under which there is this tunnel. So Machu Picchu, Tiwanaku, Cusco, and this place called the city of Cajamarca, they all follow perfectly in like a straight arrow pattern. This line, which is also, it's called the walkway or the path of Viracocha, who was the creator god, who came and taught the people, you know, the arts of science and the arts of living.
That's pretty wild.
Yeah.
I had a question. It left, but I'm looking at the clock, so I want to kind of shift because we have about 3 minutes. So you have that tour coming up, November 10th through 20th. What's going to happen? What's all going on?
Well, we're starting at Lake Titicaca, and we're going to cover all of the sites there. We're going to go to Pumapunku and Tiwanaku, which is only about an hour across the border into Bolivia, and after we finished with the Lake Titicaca area, we're going to Cusco and the Sacred Valley to look at all of the ancient megaliths. And also then we're going to Machu Picchu. So that's from November 10th until the 20th. And then there's going to be a four-day extension for those that want to stay longer. And we'll go to Nazca and then the coast of Peru, where I'm going to be living soon, which is the little town of Paracas. And that's where the culture of the incredibly elongated skulled people lived. You know, 10 days for most people or 14 for those who want to stay a little longer. And it'll be great to have David there because, you know, David loves Peru and he also wants to search during his free time. He's going to take 3 or 4 days and look for the lost gold city of Paititi.
Okay. But I think it would just be fascinating having someone like yourself or David or Hugh to be your tour guides because you would get, I think, a more realistic look at history as opposed to, it was a ritual center, and see this McDonald's cup? It was a ritualistic object.
Mm. No, that's exactly the point, because the thing is that most of the guides in Cusco call everything a temple. As if the Inca didn't sleep, didn't eat, and didn't work. You know? Mm-hmm. Well, they were constantly meditating. Really, where did they get their food from? Oh, I don't know. You know, so it's just a cheap excuse. When you find something really interesting, you go, oh, that would have been a ritual place.
Yeah.
Thanks for that, because that drives me up the wall.
Oh, but it makes TV viewing at our house very fun because we're always going, oh, look. It's a ritualistic center. Oh, look, it's a ritualistic item. You mentioned the elongated skulls, and you're doing that work on the DNA testing, and we're out of time today, but I so want to have you come back and talk about that because another really fascinating topic.
Well, it is, and hopefully we'll have David Childress for that one. But it's, we're looking at least a subspecies of human being and maybe even some kind of human hybrid. I don't want to say too much until the results come back, which should be next month, but it's a wild ride, I'll tell you that much. I'm just, you know, I'm amazed at what we're finding out.
Well, and I think it's just fascinating because there's the ones in South America, and it would be curious to look at the ones that they have from around the world to see if you find the same genetic markers.
Exactly, exactly.
Brian, we have to go. Our time is up. And I want to thank you for coming on because this has just been great. The hour went way too fast.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
And, the music hasn't come up yet. So, again, if they want to get information about the tour or want to participate, do they go to the HiddenIncaTours.com website?
Yeah, and it's on the home page, the front page. It has the Megalithomania tour. I'm also going to be doing a tour of Egypt in order to explore the relationship between Egypt and Peru with Antoine Jigal. And then I have 4 ebooks, and I just finished my fifth one today. So all of that is there, and almost 500 YouTube videos that I have filmed myself.
Cool, cool, cool. All right, well, there's music, which means we really have to go. And we will talk to you again soon, I hope.
I hope so, too. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Brian.
Okay.
And next week, we have Robin Kelly talking about the human hologram and Robert Whittaker talking about the anatomy of an epidemic. So, till next week, I'm Dr. Rita Louise. Be blessed.
Join host Dr. Rita Louise each week at this time for Just Energy Radio. Point your browser to www.justenergyradio.com for more show information and to contact Dr. Rita. Until next time, remember, it's all just energy.